podcasters and creatives to the World Builders Tavern. Today we are talking about the Gaslamp fantasy novel, The 13th Hour, with author of said work, Trudy Skies. Yay! spoiler warning for anybody who has not yet read this wonderful book, you will be spoiled. So either get reading that or save this episode for later, or just listen to all of our spoilers and enjoy the story that way. But with that, grab an ale, zero proof, always available at the counter, and pull up a chair. I'm Emma, your friendly barkeep, along with Allison.
Hello.
And Christiana.
Hi.
And our very special guest, the author of The 13th Hour, Trudy Skies. Welcome, Trudy. Would you like to introduce yourself and your novel?
Hello, so I'm Trudy Skies. I'm a British author of the Gaslamp fantasy series, The Cruel Gods. The first book is The 13th Hour, which is a Gaslamp fantasy featuring magical portals, gothic cosmic deities, great Britishisms, lots of Britishisms, I'd say that, and steampunk vibes.
I love Amazing. How much one of the characters loves tea. It feels very Yiddish. Yeah.
I don't even drink tea in real life.
Oh, no.
It's terrible.
I do. I love tea.
Oh, man. That was such a succinct succinct summary. That's fantastic. You really
They're prepared.
Yes. Love it. So we love to kick things off with our guests by asking a little bit about your world building process. So can you give us a little bit of background on how you built the world for this book and this series, and what came first? Was it the plot, the characters, or the world, or something else completely?
Well, I guess like most fantasy authors kind of get asked, where do you start when it comes to a book? Like, do you start with the world, the setting, the characters, or the plot? And it's like, I feel like each project is different. So you can either start with one or the other. But for me, I see it like an onion. This is going to be kind of weird, but I see it like a reverse onion, which is even weirder. So I have a very basic layer, which is like the story or the plot. Then I've got a character. Then I've got a vague idea for the world. And then I kind of do the basic layer. And then I kind of go around each time adding little bits until I'm kind of like the layer gets thicker and thicker. So it's like, you can't just like, because those three things are interwoven. You can't obviously have the world building without story. You can't have the story without the character. You can't have the character without the world. So it's kind of like they're interlocked. So I kind of layer it. And I find that my first ideas when I'm coming up with the world, for example, they're usually quite cliched and boring. They're usually just probably copying someone else. I'm not copying, but it's like you kind of get ideas from different areas. And it's like, yeah, this isn't that original. So you kind of go back and then you do more layers and do more layers. And then by the end, you've kind of got something that's completely deviated from your original idea, but it's probably better. So that's kind of how I do it. It's kind of like an onion. So with the 13th hour, I created 12 domains, 12 races, 12 gods. I do not recommend doing that. That is a completely ludicrous idea.
Yeah.
Like, just do not even. And I think most readers, when they read this book, they either sink or swim with it because it's either too much or it works. Mm. You're either one or the other.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, there is a lot going on, which is fantastic.
I was definitely a swimmer. I loved it so much, like the complexity of it and everything, and kind of that idea of building a world from the inside out. That is super interesting to me because I adored it. I can't give you enough praise. I loved it so much.
That's embarrassing.
No, don't be embarrassed. I'm here to like lift you up. It was so good. It was so
And the
good.
Fact that you say you start with something boring is so funny.
because it was the least boring.
Okay, so the original idea I had for the 13th hour was I wanted kind of like, I came up with this idea when I was 12, and when you come up with any ideas when you're 12, it's going to be a bit edgy and probably a bit cliched. Yeah. So the original idea was, oh, there are going to be all these elemental worlds and you travel through them via portals. And I sat on that idea for obviously years. And then during the pandemic, I started playing a lot of Skyrim, as you do.
As
you do. Okay.
So I have a Skyrim tattoo. So like, I was already obsessed, and now I'm like even more on board. So.
I modded the game like to hell and back. Like I've spent thousands of hours in that game. So I played a lot of that, and I kind of took inspiration from the Dwemer race, which is steampunk, clockpunk. Yeah. So I kind of got inspiration from that. And I like playing as a Dunmer character, and that kind of inspired the Vesper.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like inspired from that a little bit.
With and, the mushrooms and the bioluminescence and everything.
Yes, that's basically Eventide. Oh, kind of. See, it's not original at all. Yeah. But anyway. So a lot of that was inspired from the Elder Scrolls, but specifically the Daedric Princes. That was like the main inspiration for me. Because the Daedric Princes in the Elder Scrolls world, which you'll be familiar with, they have their own realms that they rule. Yeah. And they also kind of have their own mortals or immortals that are kind of like based on them. And that was kind of like where the idea came from. It was like, okay, well, we had these, if these different domains, as they were ruled by a god, and the god's obviously not a nice god because they're gods. And they've got their own mortals. And then from there, and with the kind of steampunk idea, I started thinking about, what if we had a clock? What if we had 12 races, 12 domains that fit within this clock? And then from there, it's kind of like basing, like coming up with the 12 different domains, fitting them into the clock. I mean, some of them are kind of inspired on basic like fantasy tropes. So the Glimmer, who are kind of like the sunlight people, they're basically high elves, snobby high elves. No offense to the high elves of any other world, but yeah, that's basically who they are. The Vesper are obviously dark elves, and the Necro are kind of like vampire and dead type characters. And with the original idea, I wanted to have like elements, and the domains will be based on different elements. So you've got fire, you've got water, you've got earth, you've got air, which is kind of covered. I actually have a map over here, which isn't any good.
Ah!
Not really any good for like anybody listening.
Oh,
but
yeah, you can see this on your website.
Yes, it is on the website.
Go see it. Yeah, it's like a clock or a circle divided into 12 slices with all the different domains. Yeah.
So there's obviously different elements. So we've got Rapture is based on fire, and Memoria is based on water, that kind of thing. I also wanted some based on time as well. So you've got the time people. I think I kind of took inspiration from Fae Realms as well, that I wanted to base some on the seasons. So we've got Solaris and the Glimmer, they're basically dawn, and then dusk. What else?
I love the clock. I love the clock idea so much. It's so neat.
And I also, as a huge fan of Skyrim, did not make that connection, which I think is a wonderful example of how you can draw inspiration, but create an entirely unique thing. Because I did not, I did not compare it to the Daedric gods at all.
That's just kind of how I saw
it. And then now you say it, I'm like, I get it.
It's a Daedric princess. Yeah. It's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Also, really, I really like how you can go on your website and see a list of all the different races and like drawings of them. That's really cool. So if people want to have visualizations of what these races look like, you can go to Trudy Sky's website.
I even wrote a handbook for people that were having trouble with that.
Nice.
I had one reader who was like, he couldn't get to grips with it at all. And then he got the handbook and he read through that and he's like, oh yeah, now I understand everything.
Yeah.
So there we are. That's how much went into this.
That's amazing. That kind of, so in our sort of Bible for the episode, there's a note about talking about how this is such a big world, but we didn't feel overwhelmed by it. And asking about, so that would be a great question, is like, how do you avoid sort of dumping too much on readers? And clearly that's one way that you did, is by making these sort of external, instead of putting all of that in the book and having, you know, like a big lore dump at the beginning of your book, you have it as like this ancillary material. That's brilliant. That's so good.
There's still definitely lots of info dumping in the book, but yeah, definitely lots of it.
It's hard to avoid doing any in fantasy because you have to do some. It's just, I think, deciding where to put it probably is the challenge.
Yeah. I mean, with this, like, the main challenge was, I've got these 12 races. How the hell am I going to explain 12 races? Obviously, with a new reader coming into this book, you need to set the scene. You need to let them know straight away what kind of genre this is, what the setting is, what it's all about. But you're not going to bombard them with 12 races and 12 domains straight off chapter one. You can't really do that. So that was like kind of my biggest problem with this whole first book, was trying to explain that. I kind of do that in chapter two. In chapter two, the main character has a job where she works in a tea house for a little bit. And she gets customers come through that are of various different domains. And she's doing her job during the day as the portal or the clock, the gateway known as the gate, as that changes throughout a 12-hour cycle. Because I should explain that really, that the domains, there's a magical portal in the middle of the city, and it changes based on the times of the clock. So every domain, each of the 12 domains are designated a particular time slot. And as the hours goes by, it changes around each time. So at 1 o'clock, you have Memoria, then at 2 o'clock, it changes to the next domain, which is Juniper, and it just cycles through that the 12-hour rotation. So this character is taking her 12-hour shift as the clock's rotating, and I'm kind of explaining the different domains a little bit as it kind of goes on. And the original idea was that I would have every single damn domain come through to this cafe and get served so I could introduce them one by one, but then it's like, you know what, that's probably too much for chapter two. Probably a bit. So I dialed that back a bit and just kind of focused on like the main races that were kind of important to the story at that point, which was really the Vesper, the Glimmer, because they're kind of rivals, and then the Diviner, who were kind of the bad guys. They're like the time race who can control time, and they're pretty much in charge of everything. So it's kind of like focusing on them, and then I could kind of drip feed the other domains as the story went on. And some domains get a bit more love and attention than other ones do. But we do kind of introduce all of them as the whole book goes through, but we don't actually visit all of the domains in book one, only one of them.
Ooh, so but more to come in book two then.
In book two, we do visit all of them. Book two.
You're ahead of me.
Yeah, I finished the first book for the podcast and was immediately enamored fully with all the characters. So I started book two already.
This is my second read through of book one, and I got the audiobook, and I really loved the narrator that you
put. RJ Bailey is amazing.
He's
I love
so good.
RJ.
Yeah.
I named my cat after RJ. My cat's
nice.
Right now. So he's called Bailey, my cat, named after RJ Bailey.
That's amazing. Lovely. I'm really enjoying the audiobook. It is fantastic.
RJ does a great way of doing all the different voices with different British accents. He's incredibly good like that. And I just love the fact that he's got a Birmingham accent for Drew. That's just perfect.
These
different British accents.
Yeah, Drew especially feels like a very unique character. And the rest of it, kind of like the discussion of like the rest of the godless are very, they have their reasons, and I'll get into that later. The rest of the godless kind of have their reasons, but Drew kind of still holds on to that a little bit. And that's, so Drew feels very unique to me as a character.
Holds on to what a little bit?
Yeah, holds on to her god a little bit.
Oh,
right?
Her
like
god.
She's not fully released from her god, but she cares more about the people of Greyford than she does her god kind of thing. But it's not like, you know, she's one of the few, she's the only godless who still kind of has, in my interpretation of the first book, has a little bit of belief still kind of thing.
So. Yeah. Well, and it's also, I think, mentioned that her god is kind of the nicest of all the gods. Yeah. Like, they tend to not really relatively when you're...
Trudy's making motions with her fingers.
At least that's what one of the characters says, that maybe this isn't as cruel as the other gods. Yeah. Or hasn't revealed themselves to be as cruel as the other gods.
Time will tell if they are or not.
Ooh, dun-dun-dun.
I mean, Quinn seems to think that his god is nice.
Oh, he's very naive, though.
Christiana, you had some thoughts about Quinn as like a morally gray character. Did you want to talk about that?
Yeah,
seems like a good segue. Now that we're talking about him,
Before eventually we're gonna get to the point where I'm word vomiting about you about how much I love this story and how much it means to me. But before that, I really, really liked how you played with kind of like gender roles and also disability, but also the fact that the characters are kind of morally gray. And I think Quinn is a fantastic example of that. Quinn. But the idea that he works for the wardens a little bit against his will, but he's also the unnamed benefactor. But even when he and Kale develop a relationship, he feels for Kale, he feels for the godless, but he's still kind of defending the wardens to some extent. Kind of thing. I feel like a lot of the characters kind of meet this morally gray to an extent kind of feeling. And I think it's because of the world building to some extent. Like, they're in a world where it's really hard to deny your God. It's really hard to deny your feelings. But I also am just a reader. I'm not the writer. So I'm kind of curious, was this like an intentional way of exploring the world, or was this kind of, do you attribute it more to the world or to the characters kind of thing?
Probably more to the world, to be honest. When I was designing this book, I can't even remember where Quinn came from, to be honest. That character just kind of walked onto the page and he was there. He kind of became a star in a lot of ways. And I never really kind of set out for him to be morally gray. I never really set out for him to be kind of like an opposite end to what Kale is. But he just kind of turned into that, I guess. He just kind of embraced his God and kind of went from there. But he's kind of like a logical representation of what this world is, that the average citizen is loyal to their God. Obviously, you've got the God potentially in your head, so you can't really deviate too much from that.
Yeah.
And he's very much a stickler for the rules, but he's also going through a lot of trauma in himself that he's not even aware of, because he's got memory issues. Obviously, that's a bit of a spoiler. But yeah, he's not quite in his right mind for a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And then in book two, he kind of is in his right mind. But again, the forces that are in his head are kind of a bit more antagonistic, shall we say. So he's kind of trapped. And there's a bit more of a dilemma for him there. That he's basically shackled and he can't really do much about it. Mm. So a lot of what he's thinking, especially in book two, is him just kind of like acting out what he's supposed to be rather than necessarily believing it. Mm. But that's definitely more of a book two thing.
Yeah. I definitely saw that in his character, like the kind of also the like moral to an extent struggle between like erasing his own memories to protect people, but then highlighting things in the courier and stuff to like give his future self, knowing that he's going to erase his memories, kind of like hints towards the right actions and stuff. Mm. I adored it.
Yeah, that was really clever. I did not see that coming first time.
The original draft didn't even have any of that, so that just kind of came out of nowhere as well.
Nice.
That was kind of a result of the world building, because when you have a race that can basically mess around with memories, then that kind of opens up a lot of interesting possibilities and also a lot of plot holes. So same with like the ability to control time, that also creates lots of interesting possibilities and plot holes.
Oh yeah, the plot holes with time travel. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I didn't actually notice it. I normally pick out giant plot holes when I'm watching time travel shows and then just ignore them because time travel is fun. But I don't know if I noticed any in this book. So you must have really worked those out.
Yeah.
I think book one's probably safe. Book two and book three, a little bit more time traveling.
Were there any world building things that you built and then had to change because you realized, like as you did the plot, that you had to kind of take out because it would cause too many problems with the plot? Or did you manage to kind of work everything out for the most part?
I think I mostly worked it all out, but it did spend a lot of time just staring at a screen and slightly crying. But as you do with world building.
Yeah.
I honestly can't remember if there was any major ones. Obviously, things change as they go along. The time travel one is an example of when things ever changed in the draft, because that wasn't in the first draft and that just kind of came about. And then I had to rewrite the entire thing kind of like with that in mind, because something like that changes everything else.
Yeah, that's a lot of work. How many revisions did book one take?
I don't think it took that many. Maybe two or three, which isn't even that bad, really.
Yeah, that's not bad.
The first book I ever writ was like
perhaps
seven or eight drafts. So, you know, I've done my time. I've already kind of like worked out how to do these things, I hope. So,
Do you outline a lot first, or do you?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Especially with these books, because I have to kind of like sit down and make a list of how everything's going to go. And then I have to make a list of the character motivations, because a lot of the times the story's not making sense is because the character motivations aren't clear enough. So I need to focus on them to make sure that the rest of it makes sense.
Yeah. That's a really good tip right there. Character, if your story isn't making sense,
it's the character's character. Fault.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not your fault. Characters.
Yes.
Those damn characters. Trudy, can I ask you, so you have these 12 domains, the 12 races, they're all so distinct and different. Like, you have everything from, like, a race of lion folk, essentially, to, you know, you've got these kind of shadow creatures, to you've got these, like, beings made of rocks. How did you come up with, did you, like, initially intend for them all to be very different, or did you have them maybe as being slightly more the same, or how did you come up with, like, these just 12 completely different
races? I did want them to be different, because obviously having some that are kind of the same would be a bit boring. Mm. But I think some of them are quite similar in some ways. Like the Divider and the Zephyr, their minds kind of work in similar ways, but obviously one's a bird and one's a time-traveling maniac. So slightly different in that regard. But as I said before, I kind of tried to base it on the different elements. So we had different elemental creatures. Then we had the High Elves, Dark Elves. The Ember, who were the fire people, they're basically tieflings, you could say.
Yeah.
And then we've got the vampire people, who are cool. And I tried to kind of like have opposites as well. So like the Vesper and the Glimmer are kind of paired off each other. Mm-hmm. And I represent this on the map as well, so you can't really see, but like for example, the Glimmer opposite.
Like almost like a color wheel with like complementary colors.
And I've got the Divider opposite the Necro because time and death go together so well.
Just little things like that.
But also, I mean, when I did design these domains, pretty much all of them were set in stone except for the Leander, the lion people. Because I wanted a desert thing because, again, I wanted all of the domains to be fairly unique. I didn't want them to be the same. So I knew I wanted to have a desert domain, you know, some kind of sandy domain. But I couldn't decide, it's going to sound weird, I couldn't decide between the lions or having scorpion people in top hats.
Oh.
And for a long time, I kind of debated this with my with my online friends. Like, do I have scorpion people with top hats? And they were like, yes, scorpion people. And I just thought, that's going to be really bloody weird. So in the end, I decided...
You remember the Scorpion King, the Mummy sequel with like the rock with the horrible
Yeah,
it's an abomination.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, that's I do like the lions and top hats as well.
I stick with them because lions are more British and the world's British.
If that makes sense,
that lions are British. But yeah.
they'd be like, what is this thing? Yeah.
Do you have a favorite domain, or is that like asking you to pick between your children?
It kind of is like asking me to pick between my children, but like a good parent, I do have a favorite, and it would of course be the Mesmer for me. I love the Mesmer.
Mesmer.
They don't get that much page time in book one, but in book two and three, they are absolute menace. So I do love the Mesmer. They're just constantly confused by reality.
Reeve was the Mesmer.
Poor Reeve. Upset a lot of people with Reeve.
Their world is in space, which is really cool.
And that doesn't scare them for some reason. They get scared of everything except for that.
That seems concerning.
And then on top of all of these really cool domains, you also have this incredible sort of Edwardian gas lamp aesthetic. Was that something that was also there from the beginning, or was that kind of a layer that you added afterwards to put it in a specific time?
Yeah, that was kind of always there from the beginning. I think it's kind of inspired again from the Dwemer and the Elder Scrolls. That and it's just like, it's just neat. Like, gas lamp settings are just kind of cool. But when I was developing this book or writing this book, I had no idea what genre it was. I didn't even have a clue. I was just having fun and doing whatever I wanted. Right. So it's like, I got to the end of it and I was thinking, is this steampunk? But it's not really that much steampunk. Is it? What is it? And, I mean, Amazon.com have a gas lamp fantasy category. And I was like, okay, that's the best fitting thing. So I'm going to call it gas lamp. Yeah. I'm not sure, entirely sure if it is. And I tried to tailor it a bit more towards that, because at the end, when I decided it was probably gas lamp, that it could kind of fit into that category. But on reflection, like a couple of years later, it's probably closer towards aetherpunk. There's another word for it, like it's like a kind of arcane tech punk style. I think it's probably closer to that in terms of genre, but Amazon doesn't really have a category for that.
Were you inspired by League of Legends and Arcane?
Oh, so right, Arcane, that came out, the show came out, I think, like a month after my book came out. So I could avoid any kind of like criticisms there of similarities. Now, I watched Arcane, and I've never played League of Legends because I'm a gamer. I've heard of a reputation regarding League of Legends. I stay away from League of Legends. But when Arcane came out, it blew me away. It was like the best animated show of the BoJack.
It's very good.
That I've ever seen. It's just, Arcane is just incredible. I recommend it to everyone. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm. So as I watched for it, our next season of the podcast,
we should watch Arcane. We'll have to watch Arcane.
It's just so good. But yeah, as I watched that show, it was like, oh my god, this is my book. The similarities were just incredible. It's like, oh yeah, because the cities, oh, this is very arcadey, gas lampy. Yeah, this is definitely, like, this could be Chime. Oh wait, they've got an undersea. Oh yeah, this is very similar to Chime. Oh, there's like two sisters. Yeah, that's kind of similar to what I've got. Oh wait, the bad one's called Jinx.
Yeah, one of them's even called Jinx. Yeah.
I did not see that coming. Like,
so I used to play League of Legends. And Jinx was my main. So I was very excited to sort of see a similarity there. Because she is kind of crazy. And Jinx in your book also is.
Yeah, so, a little crazy.
Yeah. So that was
so
cool.
Anybody who's listening, if you've watched Arcane and you liked it, you'll like this book. You should
definitely recommend. Yeah.
And if you like this book, watch Arcane. It's a great show. Yeah. Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's awesome. Really good. Yeah.
I almost wore my Jinx t-shirt, but I went for Final Fantasy VIII.
Oh, nice. Also great.
No wrong choice.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question as being a big giant dork who felt this book made me cry.
Oh, no.
At one point. Because I, as a non-binary person, I really, really loved the way that you kind of played with gender roles, but also more specifically with disabilities. And so I like to believe in my heart of hearts that I'm a dude vampire. And I, in my real life, unfortunately, suffer with arthritis. So Vincent being this like really cool character who had arthritis and uses the cane, which I have to use a lot of the time, kind of thing. It just totally, like, yeah, I had it. Also, I'll be super real and say I'm having a flare up this week and was feeling very sensitive. So I read the moment where he was saying, like, you know, like, why would my God do this to me? Like, why would this happen, kind of thing? And then also on the flip side, the scene where Quen asks him to take out Elijah and says, oh, take care of him. And he expects him to use his necro powers, but instead he just punches him in the face super hard. I was like, yes, yes. Like, that's so me. Like, oh my God. And I guess my kind of question is, like, how did you approach that? Like, did you have sensitivity writers? Because you really captured, like, for me, like, someone who deals with arthritis. Like, did you have sensitivity readers for it? Or, like, what was the approach for that?
I didn't actually have sensitivity readers, but I did do a lot of research and spoke to people of various different backgrounds before kind of, like, trying to approach it. Because there's obviously a lot of different areas of the book that can be quite sensitive. The way I portrayed Vincent was actually something that I kind of worried about a lot, because I didn't want it to sound like it said that people like Vincent are the way they are because of their God, because of a divine punishment or whatever. I didn't want that to be the message that I put across, because a lot of the religious themes of the book kind of come from my own childhood. I have a very negative thoughts and opinions of them, obviously, that kind of comes across. I definitely didn't want it to seem like that Vincent is being punished by his God, and therefore anybody else that suffers from arthritis is also being punished by their God, because that is definitely not what I believe. But in this world, it's kind of plausible that that would be. something that the gods would do.
Yeah, you're actually making me tear up.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's so...
oh, it's okay.
So, just very accurate to the experience where, you know, like, it's like a frustration. Like, you know, it's not your fault. You know, it's not some other person's fault or anything like that. But just kind of that it sucks. It sucks that you want someone to be mad at about it. Because it just, like, I was first diagnosed when I was 26 kind of thing. Like, I didn't expect that kind of thing. And Vincent really, like, spoke to me. Also because I'm obsessed with vampires and all these lovely things. And all these lovely things. But yeah, it was just, it, like, really spoke to me in a lot of ways. That kind of anger that comes with being disabled, that I think sometimes people want to pretend like it's always like a barrier you overcome and you're a better person because it kind of thing. But, like, sometimes you're allowed to be pissed. You're allowed to become godless. Yeah. You're allowed to just, like, be upset about the situation. And I think Vincent really captured that for me. So.
I'd love to hear more about how religion inspired, because there's so much so many undertones of religion in this book with the gods. And it was really neat how praying to a god is a direct connection to them, because that's almost like the opposite of in real life, where when you're a religious person and you pray to God, you actually don't know for sure. Like, it's more of an act of faith, whereas in your books it's not faith because you know the gods are real.
Yeah.
And they can find you. Like, that's definitely creepy. Don't pray to your god, because they will find you if you can pray to them, which is very cool twist that you don't often see.
I kind of see it as like the gods, they experience all of their mortals all at once, because gods have that kind of cosmic ability, so they're always aware of their mortals, but because they have so many, it's kind of like background noise, it's like static. So therefore, if you wanted to pray to your specific god and get their attention, that prayer is like a direct line that's kind of like shouting in their ears, or just kind of trying to get their attention more. And a god can choose to either listen in, like answer the phone, so to speak, or just kind of ignore it, which I imagine a lot of them probably do. But so that's kind of what prayer is. And some of the gods obviously are quite happy to accept prayers and are quite happy to speak with their mortals on that kind of level, whereas other gods are like, what the hell do you want? And they just snap their souls out if they get a bit too annoying.
Oh my god, there's the one scene during the beginning where a character prays to their god to heal them, and then it says to and Kale's telling him to pray, and he's like, he doesn't care. He's not going to do it. And then the guy dies, and I was like, oh my goodness, that's so powerful and just like emotional. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of the gods do care and some just don't.
Yeah. So did your own religious experience influence how you wrote this book?
Oh yeah, it definitely did. It's obviously kind of can be controversial to talk about religious issues. I've not actually had any people read this book and actually hate it for that reason. So it's probably doing a good job at drawing in the right crowd, because it'd be great if someone wanted to buy it and burn it, you know, that'd be great.
I mean, that's one of the great things about like sci-fi and fantasy, is sometimes that's a safe way to explore themes, because you're not writing about, you know, religion in our world, it's religion in this other world, and you get to express that and explore that, but it's not, you know, it's in this kind of safely isolated world.
I did try to be very careful with that I don't try and base it completely on real life religions. I didn't want it to be like, this is definitely like a Christian, although it probably is, but yeah. So I didn't want to kind of base it on that, but certain races are definitely a bit more geared towards certain things. So the Glimmer I would kind of describe as being a Catholic inspired. They're very, very strong about their religion. They're probably the strongest of them. But again, they're not quite Catholic, because they love their female body, they love showing off, and that's definitely not Catholic probably. And again, I kind of base it on real life politics, and that the Glimmer and the Diviner are kind of like what I would describe as conservative types. They're very conservative. in the UK I'd call them Tories. They basically kind of act like that. When I told RJ Bailey about what the different races would sound like, I was like, yeah, these sound like Tories. And he was like, yep, got it. So incredibly snobby, horrible people. Yep, got it. So you know what it was about.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. I really liked that nuance of talking about how the sins were different for different domains, depending on what your God liked or didn't like. Yeah. What was sin for one realm wasn't for another. And the fact that, you know, in theory, the wardens are trying to make it all equal, so every domain is allowed to do its thing, which, like so often in real life, that theory didn't work so well
doesn't
to put
work.
Into practice. Yeah, but it was very cool to see that.
I suppose in this society, like, pretty much every single race kind of do what the diviner do, so they kind of like say, yeah, these are the sins, these are not the sins, and the ember, they're the opposite, but then the diviner like, okay, well, the ember are horrible, we don't care what they think. So the ember kind of get treated like crap, and we obviously have a tier, a social tier, where we have some people at the top and some people at the bottom, and it's obviously the more religious kind of like sin is bad that are at the top, and then all of the poorer people and the people that are more likely to sin in their eyes are the ones that are kind of at the bottom of the social chain and therefore living in the inner city. And it's kind of reflected in that tier. So, and that's what makes Chaim such a horrible place in times. It's great if you're in the right domain, not so great if you're not.
I also really liked seeing the sort of different views of the gods and how different characters would rationalize the fact that the gods were cruel. Like, I forget which character it was, whether it was Quen or Elijah or somebody, but they were basically saying that, oh, well, the god is corrupt because their people are corrupt, and so if we get rid of all these bad people, the god will be good again. And it's just like, yeah, people are so great at convincing of themselves and stuff, so that just seems so realistic that people would be like, well, I see this, but it doesn't fit into my worldview, so I have to spin it so it will fit into my worldview, and now I can go for it, which was...
That's exactly how real people do it.
I think that's also why I, like, love the godless so much, of, like, that question of, like, is this fair? Like, is this actually okay kind of thing? And I think that's something that some writers and world builders or creatives of the other sort, like, it's easy to make an evil god, it's easy to make a god who just sucks kind of thing, right? But it's a different thing to create a kind of that kind of moral grayness where it's like, oh, they're asking for these teeds and they're saying these things that, like, you can't outright deny, but you can't outright support either. And I think that's part of why I loved this book so much, is because it's just so in between. So
well, we could keep talking about this for forever, but unfortunately we are coming close to our time here, so I'm going to take this opportunity to ask Trudy, what are you working on? If you can tell us, we'd love for you to do a little plug. What's your next project? What are you working on? What can we look forward to seeing from you?
Well, I've literally just finished the third and final book, which is The End of Time. So it ended up being really quite large. I don't think it's going to fit in a paperback. I'll have to figure it out. So that's going to be releasing on the 1st of May, touch wood.
Ooh, nice.
Amazing.
And that's the end of the trilogy. And then after that, I've got lots of ideas, but I haven't got anything solid yet. But I would like to return to Tribe at some point. I'm hoping to do a prequel series based on a character called Mortimer Gast. He appears in book 2 and book 3.
That's a great name. I'm so intrigued already. Just that name is awesome.
So it's gonna be a necro based story as a prequel.
Oh, that's
Christiana.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Yes.
He is the horrible little vampire freak who wants nothing for us to rule. But yeah.
Well, this episode of the podcast will be airing in April. Is that or is
yeah?
It
so it'll out? Be come out in the next book. The third book will come out in 1 month from when this episode airs.
So everybody who's listening, read book 1 and 2, and then you can be ready and excited for the third book, which that's awesome. That's super exciting. And then, so with that, we're going to head to Last Call. So here is where we are going to give you, the listeners, some concluding questions and thoughts that you can apply to your own world building. So maybe Trudy, I'll let you kick it off. If you have one piece of advice for listeners on world building that you've learned from writing this series, what would you give people to walk away with?
I would say if you're stuck on an idea or struggling to come up with ideas, then a lot of the times world building is in the mind, it's subconscious. So step away, take a break, go for a walk, do the dishes, and just let your brain do it in the background and the ideas will come to you rather than trying to force them.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
Especially if you're an overthinker like me, where you you just get stuck in a spiral. And it's like, no, you got it. That's great. Allie, is there anything that you took away from either the 13th hour or our conversation on the podcast today that you think listeners can really benefit from?
I think I've said this before, and maybe even in the next episode after this one, I've said it because we recorded them out of order. But I really like how Trudy talked about you talk about writing in layers. I think that can be really good for, because sometimes I just want my draft to be perfect right off the bat, and it's like, no, that's not how that works. So just thinking about it as like layering, slowly layering your onion or maybe your cake or something yummier than an onion, and working, looking at it that way, and that it doesn't have to be perfect right off the bat.
That is how pearls are made, is the oyster has one grain of sand and then slowly covers it with more and more layers. So when you're making the pearl of your story,
I mean, I'm sure some people love onions, so maybe that's good for some people.
I'll eat an onion.
And Christiana, what world building advice or questions do you have for the listeners?
This is pretty specific to the world that we were discussing, but also weirdly vague.
The perfect advice.
It's a very on brand for me. If you want people to be against the gods in a world that's very unlike ours, I think you need to make some kind of real world connections. So, for example, the gods in this world suck. No offense, Trudy. I think that's how you decide. They all kind of suck. Like,
the series is called The Cruel Gods.
Yeah, so. They're all mean and they all suck. And that's one thing to say, oh, you live in Chime and you're dealing with all these things. That's not necessarily something the average reader can relate to. But for me, I am Vincent. Vincent is me. having a god make someone arthritic. Having a god make someone not know who their parents are. Having a god, you know what I mean? Like having these kind of real world also experiences will help the reader connect a little bit more to get on board with the godless. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, the gods suck. You should be on board with the godless from the get-go. But having these characters who kind of have these real world earth experiences gets you so much more invested. So that's something I would say in your world building and in your writing. Consider, even if it's a world very much outside of our own, find a little way to tie it back.
It's like a great example of that, like showing, not telling, which is, you know, kind of controversial, like there's time and places, but you know, if we had only heard characters say, oh, well, the gods are so cruel, they're so cruel, that's just being told it, but you see it, you're seeing how the gods have impacted people and how that's, which is so much more human and connecting. And I was really struck by just listening to all of your inspiration for all the different domains and the different races and how it comes from things that are really popular, like Skyrim and Tieflings and all of these things. But when you read the book, you don't, like, none of us went, oh, well, that's this thing. So it's just, it's just a reminder that, like, it's okay to take inspiration from other stuff. And it's not, you know, necessarily, like, it's not plagiarism. It's not copying. It's just that's what artists do. And artists have been doing since the beginning of time, is being inspired by other art. And you're going to make it your own. And by the time you incorporate it into your world and your story, it's going to be so unique that nobody's going to recognize it as what inspired it. So don't be afraid to see something in a video game that you like and be like, that's cool. How can I incorporate that into my world? And although if you do get sued for copyright, don't blame the podcast. We accept no responsibility
not our fault.
Washing our hands.
Yeah. We are not liable for anything that we say on the podcast. but thank you, Trudy, so much for joining us today. This has been a fantastic conversation. We could talk about this for forever. I can't wait to read book 2 and 3. We're super excited.
I think I'm going to get the audiobook of 2 and 3 because I'm really enjoying it
as well. I read the first one, but the audiobook sounds like it would be really cool.
Marty, but yes. Away into book two. Thoroughly enjoying it. So. Nice.
But yeah, unfortunately, this does bring us to closing time. We would love to stay longer, but we've got tips to count here at the counter. So thank you again, Trudy, for joining with us or for talking with us today. And thank you again to our listeners for joining us at the tavern. If you just can't bear the thought of waiting two whole weeks for another episode, you should definitely join us on Patreon at patreon.com/worldbuilderstavern for access to our bonus after-hour shows. You can also connect with us on Twitter at WBTavernPod, on TikTok at WorldBuildersTavern, and on Discord, where we are the WorldBuilders Tavern. And Trudy, where can listeners find you on the internet if you want to be found?
I can be found on my website, which is TrudySkies.com, or on Blue Sky. I'm around there somewhere. I also have my own Discord server, which is aptly named the Daydream Domain. And I use that to post memes and cat pictures and also spoilers of my own books.
Oh my goodness. We love that. Yeah. Perfect. So head on over there. And don't forget, Trudy, can you remind us again, the final book in the trilogy is coming out May 1st. May 1st. Ooh. Easy May to 1st. Remember. May Day. Pick up the book. Finish the trilogy. Cannot wait to read it. And we cannot wait to meet all of you listeners here again at the tavern. We hope to serve you again soon. But until next time, scram.
G'day!
Hi, thank you.